We're off to the races, powered by The Racing Biz, your independent voice for Mid-Atlantic racing and breeding. On the web at www.theracingbiz.com. And on the radio every Saturday morning, it's Off to the Races. Here's your host.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for spending a little bit of your Saturday morning with us here on Off to the Races Radio, and welcome. My name's Frank Vespi, and for the next 60 minutes, we're going to be talking thoroughbred racing and breeding in Maryland, across the Mid-Atlantic, and around the country. Today's show, as always, powered by The Racing Biz. TheRacingBiz.com is the website. We've got the socials, Facebook, Twitter, all that jazz. Look for at The Racing Biz. And of course, a free mobile app. Pick that up for your Apple and Android devices. And never miss a breaking story. Free mobile app for The Racing Biz, TheRacingBiz.com. Now, we've got a whole ton of things to do today. Got all kinds of news breaking. We've got Maryland Racing Commission Chairman Mike Algio resigned this week. We've got the first appointments to the Maryland Racetrack Operating Authority. Going to talk to Mike Algio about his resignation. Going to talk to Alan Foreman about the Racetrack Operating Authority. We've got trainer Carrie Bryan coming up. She'll be coming up inside of 20 minutes left in the program. So she's going to be coming up towards the end of the hour with about 20 to go. So look for her at about 20 of 11. Good stuff there. We've got Richard Hackerman, attorney at law. He's going to give us some info on ownership structures, and want to give a shout out to a couple of our show supporters, including Richard Hackerman, attorney at law, Wanamakers online horse auction site, Wanamakers.com, the site. They are going to have an auction. Their June catalog is now live, and you can bid on the horses on June 22nd from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's the latest upcoming Wanamakers sale. Also, Maryland Horse Breeders Association and True Valor, the stallion standing at Northview Stallion Station. Like I said, former Maryland Racing Commission Chairman Michael Algio going to join me in about 5. And after that, Alan Foreman of the MTHA going to talk about the Racetrack Operating Authority. End of the hour, 20 to 11, so about 10:40. Carrie Bryan, the trainer, is going to join me. So a lot to do here on Off to the Races. So without further ado, let's bring in Richard Hackerman, attorney at law, to talk ownership structure. Richard Hackerman joining me now to talk about some legal matters. And Richard, you know, the old model, I guess, of in horse racing was I bred a horse, I raced the horse in my name. That was the end of the deal. Nowadays, we got partnerships. We got all sorts of different structures. We got a lot of different things, a lot of different options that are out there. And I wonder if you could speak to maybe some of the different ownership structures somebody might encounter getting into racing and what they ought to be looking for.
Thank you, Frank. There are various partnerships. There are various different structures you can get into if you want to join with others to get involved in thoroughbred racing. There's general partnerships. There's syndications, there's limited liability companies. There are groups that are professionally run, the most famous one being West Point. There's much smaller versions of that floating around the country. There are various factors you want to look at, you know, with regard to, you know, what you invest in and how you invest. You want to be clear before you invest on what the purpose of the partnership is. Is it going to be claiming horses? Is it going to be two-year-olds? Is it going to be pinhooking? Is it going to be breeding? You want to know how many partners you're going to have and how much capital the structure is going to raise. You want to know what it is they're going to purchase. Are they going to purchase older horses? Are they going to purchase yearlings? Are they going to try to flip them? Or are they going to get it from two-year-old sales? And are the groups going to be professionally managed, that someone with experience and someone that you can trust to manage it? So there are various different ways you can go about it. Are you going to have a vote? Are you going to have a say in where the horse races or what horses are going to be purchased? What type of vote do you have? Are you a partner? Are you a limited partner? Are there going to be monthly expenses? And how much are those going to be? How do you get out? If you get involved, do your monthly expenses go on forever? And is there an exit strategy for you and or a horse? So a lot of different things you need to look at before you get involved in an investment in thoroughbred racing.
Now, it's sort of famously not an investment, typically in the sense of not something you want to be doing if you're trying to actually make money. I mean, buying horses is something you should do with play money and not the mortgage money. But, you know, there you just raised a lot of different things to think about if you're getting into a partnership. What's the benefit of getting into a partnership?
You can have more fun with more horses with less expense. So if you're a 50% owner, that means you're footing 50% of the purchase price and 50% of the bills. If you're a 1% owner, you're putting up 1% of the purchase price, 1% of the bills, and your monthly risk obviously would be much lower. Obviously, the lower percentage you have, the lower say you're going to have. But again, if you have a lower interest and it's professionally managed, some people have a lot of fun. I mean, we all see on TV when these mobs of people seem like they're crowding around. Those people have micro shares of various horses, and they don't have any serious real interest in the horse, but they seem to be having a lot of fun.
Winning races is always a lot more fun than not. All right. Any last thought on Yeah, exactly. Any last thought on partnership structures?
I don't know if, you know, I don't have a strong feeling that a corporation or LLC or a general partnership or a limited partnership is, you know, one is better than the other. I think each one depends on the circumstance. I would be careful if you get in with a large group that they're complying with any federal state security law requirements. I think that's an important thing, or whether or not, you know, their financially reporting practices comply with applicable law. So, you know, with the large groups in particular, I'd be very careful with that.
All right, good advice. His name is Richard Hackerman. His website's richardhackerman.com. You got ownership questions or other legal questions about the equine world, he's the man to talk to. Richard, thanks so much for joining us here on Off to the Races.
Thank you very much for having me, Frank.
That was friend of the program, Richard Hackerman, attorney at law, giving us some info and insights into ownership structures, looking to own a thoroughbred. He might be a man to talk to. You want to get in a partnership or structure a partnership to protect yourself and your friends. So good stuff there. All right. We talked about some news from the week a little bit earlier, and among those news items, Michael Algio, chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission, submitted his resignation earlier this week, effective immediately, telling Governor Wes Moore that he was done as chairman. So Mike Algio going to step down. He joined me to talk about why, what the commission has accomplished over the last several years, and some of the challenges he sees in the years to come. Here's Mike Algio.
Michael, good morning. We're going to make a little bit of news here. You are now the former chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission. Welcome to the program.
Frank, how are you? Yes, I am. I'm the former chairperson. So that's the news of the day. And as always, thank you for having me back on your show.
Oh, it's our pleasure. This is a newsworthy little moment. So you did leave a little bit prior to the conclusion of your term. What precipitated the decision to step down?
Yeah, you know, I have been doing this since 2016, but for 1 year when Commissioner Davitt took over as chairman, I have been chair of the Racing Commission. My term as a commission member would expire in a year, in July 2024. But as you well know, the chairman is appointed by the governor and serves at the pleasure of the governor. Under the statute, the chairman is supposed to only serve one-year terms and can only serve two consecutive one-year terms. And so that would be up by my calculation in October. But I just thought after 7 years of being on the commission and with a new governor in place, and with the creation of the new Maryland Racing Authority, I just felt it was time to hand over the reins, so to speak. And I thought about it a lot. And I talked to my family about it because I had spent a lot of time on a myriad of issues involving the industry. It is a volunteer position, but I will tell you there was nothing volunteer about it. It was very time consuming, but it was a great ride. I will tell you that what a tremendous honor to have served on the commission. I'm very grateful to Governor Hogan for appointing me in 2016. I know that when I was first appointed, that a lot of heads turned, like, who is this fellow? And honestly, I was as surprised as everybody else. But I did dedicate myself to trying to do the best I could for the industry, for both the thoroughbred and standardbred and the breeders. And it's been a challenge, as you well know, in many ways. But I will tell you, the best part of it all is having learned an awful lot about the industry, but most importantly was meeting great people, great friends that will be friends for life. So I just thought that given all of the circumstances, it was best for, you know, and the governor had replaced three of our longtime commission members, and we had new people coming on. So I just felt it was a good time to give Governor Moore the opportunity to select his person.
Yeah, certainly a lot of turnover at the commission. Tom Bowman, David Hayden, Tom Weinbrenner, all coming off the commission recently, as well as you. So certainly it's going to be a different looking commission in a month or two than it has been up to now. Now, you mentioned that a lot of people in the industry were surprised when you came in as chairman, which I think is an accurate assessment. From your perspective, what surprised you about coming to work as the regulator of the racing industry?
Well, there really was, I mean, again, coming in, I had spoken with Governor Hogan actually at the end of his term, just right before Christmas this year, and we chatted about the appointment. And again, his thought was, and he's a very wise man, and he knew that there was the reference to peace in the valley that people like to use. He knew that there was some issues maybe between the thoroughbreds and the standardbreds, issues between the horsemen and the breeders. And he told me that he wanted somebody that was not involved in the industry, somebody that had the experience that I had serving as a circuit court judge, that would be able to conduct the hearings, listen to people, and try to make fair decisions. So that was his rationale. And then when I came on, I mean, immediately it was very clear to me that there were just great people in the industry. Dr. Bowman reached out to me right away. We had a very long meeting. Executive Director Mike Hopkins reached out to me. We sat down, had a very long meeting. And same thing with Alan Foreman, David Richardson, Tim Keith, just good people to say, hey, we know that you're kind of a novice. We'd like you to come out and listen to us. These are our issues. These are the things you're going to be dealing with. You do have to learn the hydraulics of the industry in order to understand it. Everybody has different interests in various outcomes of what they're looking for. So I think it was important to learn that from the get-go. I met and, again, worked closely with members of the commission that representing the standardbred side, Clarissa Coughlin, Tammy Lafferty, now Bobby Lillis, obviously Tom Weinbrenner, and same thing on the thoroughbred side. I would listen to Conrad Wason, David Hayden, Tom Bowman, those that were on the thoroughbred side. So I learned an awful lot about the industry and how it operates. And I also learned some of the challenges that we have had that have faced us for 7 years. And I realized, you know, those challenges don't seem to go away. They just seem to change. I've always often compared it to the playing the whack-a-mole game. As soon as you address one issue, one crisis, up pops another. And so I just thought it was time for new blood, younger blood, somebody that can come in and have a fresh look. And and God bless them, because it's a great industry, and I feel very honored to have served for the past 7 years.
Talking with Michael Algia, the now former chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission here on Off to the Races. And I was going to get to this question a little later, but you sort of just teed it up. So what do you see as the most pressing and important challenges that racing's got to confront now?
One of the cornerstones of the Racing Commission when I was chair was safety and welfare. And clearly, given recent circumstances at Laurel, and then during the undercard races at Pimlico during the Preakness, and then at Derby, and of course at Belmont, we have to continue to address those issues. Safety and welfare is most important. A lot of that now is going to be as oversight by HISA, and HISA has moved in as the federal authority to do what the Racing Commission had been doing. But that clearly is extremely important. And then it's difficult to have a vision looking forward when you look back and see all the changes and all the pivoting that has taken place. I think I could write a book, Frank. When I first came on, we were talking about the Maryland Stadium Authority Study 1 and Study 2, and that was Pimlico's too old, shut it down, raise it, cost too much to fix. And so that was the direction we were going to go, and they wanted to move everything to Laurel. The Preakness, the Breeders' Cup was going to come to Laurel. That's where we were going to go. And then, of course, Baltimore City got upset at that idea, and Mayor Pugh and the leaders of Baltimore City filed suit against back then the Stronach Group. And then, of course, that challenge between the Stronachs, Linda and Frank, and that litigation was moving in an ugly direction. I remember that particular Preakness year that there were signs flying over Pimlico, save Pimlico. And then, in comes Jack Young, and he talks to Belinda, and all of a sudden now we have some discussion, some movement, and out of that came the rebranding from the Stronach Group to First Racing, the suits dismissed, and the birth of the redevelopment plan. And I will tell you that when that was done, the idea of the 12-day festival at Pimlico and redirecting reframing, if you will, the Pimlico itself, changing the direction of that, unifying park heights with Mount Washington, and all of that seemed very exciting. They were going to move in Laurel. There was going to be two tracks. It's all exciting. And then, boom, the conversation stalled. We get hit by the pandemic. We get hit by inflation. No one is doing anything. The Stadium Authority is very upset because they've gone way over budget, and all of a sudden the redevelopment plan from that perspective goes up in flames. And now we come back in, and now we have the creation of this year, the Maryland Racing Authority. So it's just it has been a process. And I'm going to be as interested as everybody else to see where this goes and how this all ends.
And if the chairman or former chairman of the Racing Commission doesn't know where it's all going or ending, then it's going to be tough for anybody else to.
Well, I wish I did. I really do. And I want to be optimistic. I mean, I really think, what tremendous history there is in Maryland Racing and at Pimlico. And let's not forget that, from Seabiscuit, the War Horse, to the Great Triple Crown winners, Secretariat and American Pharoah and Justified. It was a tremendous history, and I don't think we can overlook that. And I love Pimlico. I love the history that's there. But Frank, you and I have been there when bathrooms don't work and things are falling down in the middle of the card, or it's just We got to make it happen. Something's got to be done.
Yeah, no, that's clearly true. Kind of a last question here, and I'll let you go. But I did want to ask, how do you see, you reference HISA, you reference the Racetrack Operating Authority. We still have a racing commission. How are all these pieces going to fit together?
Well, I'm going to plead ignorance. I don't know how they're going to fit together. When I came in fact, the question I often get now is, and this is by so many people, oh, so Maryland has created this a new racing authority to oversee Maryland racing, so there is no more commission. That's the question I'm getting. And so that's the perception of people. And, you know, perceptions carry a lot of weight. And so, you know, in terms of the role of the racing commission itself, you know, when they took the Maryland Stadium Authority now has the responsibility, they took that from the commission, which I was very happy about. When HISA came in, and HISA now controls safety and welfare and drug testing and oversight, and now with the creation of the Maryland Racing Authority, I believe that the role of the Maryland Racing Commission has been diminished significantly. It has been emasculated significantly. And it's just not what it was when I started in 2016. And so I don't, it's going to be really interesting to see how these two entities, the Racing Authority and the Racing Commission, work together. The simple answer is that the commission is a regulatory body, period. And that's what we're supposed to do, to make certain regulations are enforced. I have been told that the Racing Authority is really just fail-safe creation in the event that the corporation should leave Maryland and someone needed to run the day-to-day operations. But until it actually formed and we see how it operates, we still have a lot of questions.
All right, we're going to let you go. Michael Algio, former chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission, 7 years on the commission. Thanks for joining us on the program, and thanks for your work over the years to advance Maryland racing.
Frank, I'm very, very grateful. I do want to say this before I go. I want to thank you. As I had said to you previously, you certainly do a great job covering Maryland racing, both in print and off to the races. And most importantly, and I've dealt with journalists and the media in a lot of different ways, and you've always been very open and very fair, and thank you for your contributions to the Maryland racing industry.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
That was former Maryland Racing Commission Chairman Mike Algio stepping down earlier this week, effective immediately. So some news there breaking here on Off to the Races Radio, powered by The Racing Biz, theracingbiz.com. Still to come here on Off to the Races Radio, trainer Carrie Bryan going to join us in about 20 minutes. She's got a horse in the Stormy Blue Stakes at Laurel, and an interesting backstory here for trainer Carrie Bryan, who is definitely on the right way up. Okay, let's turn our attention now to something new in Maryland. Maryland Thoroughbred Racetrack Operating Authority came into being with the passage of legislation at the Maryland General Assembly earlier this year. What the heck is a Maryland Racetrack Operating Authority, you say? No better person to ask that question to than Alan Foreman. Alan is general counsel of the Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association and was appointed late last week as one of the members of the new Racetrack Operating Authority. Here's my conversation with Alan Foreman.
Alan, good morning and welcome to Off to the Races. Thanks for taking a few minutes to join me here and to help us figure out what the heck the Racetrack Operating Authority is and what it's going to do.
So good morning, Frank. Thanks for having me on. Happy to do it. as I think you're aware, the governor appointed me last Friday to the newly created Maryland Thoroughbred Racetrack Operating Authority. I'll be serving on the authority with eight others. The Maryland Racing Commission has an ex officio member, a non-voting member. There are members, one from each of the impacted communities, and then I am the MTHA's designee. Tom Rooney is the designee from the Maryland Horse Breeders Association. The president of the Senate has designated Lou Ullman, who is a very prominent thoroughbred owner, former chairman of the Maryland Racing Commission. The Speaker of the House has appointed Chuck Tilden, vice president of the University of Maryland Medical Systems and a former member of the Maryland Racing Commission. I believe that Medco's appointee will be Tom Sadowski, who we've worked with for the past year when Medco was brought in by the General Assembly to become involved in the redevelopment project. The Stadium Authority will be represented by its chair. And Greg Cross, who I've worked with over the past year, a very, very, very bright and accomplished lawyer with the law firm Venable in Baltimore, will be chairing the commission and or the authority. I call it commission, but it will be chairing the authority.
Now, you are one of the people who, you know, I think was pushing for this concept of a racetrack operating authority. What is the authority's mandate exactly?
Well, the mandate in the statute is that we are to make recommendations to the General Assembly on what we believe to be the best interests of the racing industry going forward from where we are right now. And essentially, the authority is going to take over the redevelopment plan that is stalled, not moving forward, and taking into consideration what the recommendations have been from the Maryland Stadium Authority and the work that's been done up to this point to try to take the plan forward and get it jump-started. But it will also have the authority if, as we thought might happen over the past 6 months, there is a breakdown between the stakeholders and the First Racing with respect to the continuation of live racing in the state. The authority will have the ability to step in immediately and to ensure that live racing continues in the state uninterrupted. So it would have the ability to apply to the Maryland Racing Commission for approval to take over the race meets and conduct operations if the Stronach Group is not willing to do so, or the Stronach Group of First Racing, or if there is an impasse with respect to an extension of what has been the 10-year agreement. We're now operating under a current extension that expires on June 30th, but that extension has been renewed through December 31st to allow the authority to begin to do its work. The authority has to make certain recommendations to the General Assembly in a report that's due by December 1. So there's a lot of ground that has to be plowed between now and December 1st, and the authority needs to get going.
Yeah, it really does, because as you say, that it's a pretty significant thing, because as I understand it, the report is to sort of envision the best operating model for Maryland racing going forward. Is that correct?
Yeah, and in fact, Frank, the stakeholders were somewhat mandated to report to the General Assembly last September on that very concept, because the plan had stalled. We were, at least this time last year, we being the horsemen, to sit down with the Maryland Stadium Authority, look at, in particular, the situation with respect to Laurel, to look at the feasibility of either trying to cut costs or downsize the project at Laurel. And as part of that effort with the Stadium Authority, we were forced to look at other options because the Stadium Authority determined that the cost to redevelop Laurel would probably be almost double what was anticipated when the concept plan was done. And then superimposing on top of that was this tax issue that has vexed the project. And that is that there's a provision of the federal tax code. The press keeps reporting it as a state tax code provision. It's a federal tax code provision that imposes a capital gains tax on the owner of properties where arenas, sporting facilities are situated. And to the extent that the public dollars are used for capital improvements on those facilities, they're taxed to the owner at capital gains rates. So with respect to Laurel, there would be a tax that could be as high as $30-40 million on the project if Belinda Stronach did not convey the property to the state or to, in this case, Anne Arundel County. and the likelihood of either the state or the county buying Laurel from the Shronic Group was probably remote. So there are a host of problems with respect to Laurel, which forced us to look at other options. And there's been a lot of discussion, I know, about the Pimlico becoming the hub of Maryland racing, building a training facility. But that's all spelled out in the Stadium Authority's report that they filed with the General Assembly on December 31st. If anyone had taken the time to read it, they would see it. And it's not something that's just been sprung on everyone in the last 60 days.
No, I think that's right. It's been clear for a while that Maryland was going to, essentially have to get down to one track, kind of slim down for financial and economic reasons. And now politically, the politics are sort of behind Pimlico. But that, as you say, that seems like to me it poses a whole host of other challenges, including that Pimlico is not big enough to host all the horses and horsemen that you need to have year-round racing.
I mean, that's the principal problem. To the extent that, the original concept plan contemplated that Pimlico was going to get redeveloped, but also redeveloped as a commercial zone for the redevelopment of the Park Heights area in Baltimore City, and that racing was going to be consolidated at Laurel. In fact, what even got that going was an effort by the Shronic Group to essentially close Pimlico and move racing to Laurel and build a super track at Laurel. Unfortunately, we now know that the feasibility of that project is very much challenged. And so, Pimlico is going to get new racing surfaces, a new grandstand. And so I think at least people were suggesting that, you have these new racing surfaces, new grandstand at Pimlico. They're going to be sitting, 10, 11 months a year. Wouldn't it be more feasible if you have to downsize to use Pimlico as your hub? We realize that it's not big enough to do that. You can't bring 1,400 horses up to Pimlico. You don't have sufficient housing for backstretch workers. You don't have the infrastructure. And how do you make that work? And so the idea was, let's look at Pimlico and maybe look at a training center. It's been a challenge just to look at developing the training center portion of it. And now when you see what's happened to Churchill, where they've had to shut the meet down, they have options in Kentucky to move to other racetracks. We don't if we're going to downsize to just Pimlico. So there are a host of issues, challenges, options that are going to be in the lap of the authority. And that's precisely what the authority is going to be looking at, is what's best, and it should be the mandate. What is best for Maryland racing going forward? We don't have gaming, and we're not going to have gaming at our facilities. Our revenue stream is different than our neighboring states. And what can we best do with the revenue stream that we have available to us to make Maryland still a showplace for racing that conducts year-round racing?
Talking with Alan Foreman, General Counsel of the Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association and newly appointed member of the Maryland Racetrack Operating Authority. Alan, the thing that just popped into my head while you were saying, Churchill has had these problems and had to shift over to Ellis Park, and what would we do in Maryland if we were down to just Pimlico? And the big T, here we come, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, the entire industry is in a different place today than it was prior to the Derby week. Not dissimilar to the way we felt after the crisis at Santa Anita, and to some extent 10 years ago when we had the problems at Aqueduct. We're very severely challenged in the public eye right now. The media is not giving us any slack. They are questioning, and I'm talking about non-racing media. But they're questioning whether we should have the social license to continue our business. And so all of this, we're under the microscope. We had this very problem when we did the redevelopment plan that was enacted by the General Assembly, and we spent a substantial amount of time defending our industry to the Maryland General Assembly. And those who read the Redevelopment Act will see that there are a lot of safety, health, safety, and welfare measures that are built into that plan. And I think we're going to be challenged again when whatever the authority comes up with to answer the questions of how does this best address the health, safety, and welfare of the horses, And is this plan in the long-term best interest of the state, given all that's going on right now?
Now, you've alluded to this, saying writ large, not just, you know, Maryland has these very sort of specific facility problems that are a huge challenge and really have been for decades. But racing writ large has plenty of problems of its own as a sport, as an industry, in terms of, you know, really kind of losing the fight for the gambling dollar, in terms of shrinking fall crops, in terms of, as you just alluded to, health and safety and the social license to operate. I think that this operating authority is going to really need to be a force for thinking outside the box and for doing things differently and for really reimagining what Maryland racing is and can be. Do you agree with that? And do you feel like this is the right group of people to accomplish that?
I think you're absolutely right. But I felt that way when we did the concept plan, that we had a very unique opportunity and that we need to seize the opportunity because it may not come again. I feel even more strongly about that right now. I'm very concerned about the future of the industry. We have massive challenges. We have challenges with competition for the gambling dollar. We have challenges from competition from our neighboring states that are better positioned than we are. But I have to tell you, there are only two racing jurisdictions in the United States that are looking to the future. One is New York with its massive redevelopment plan that just got approval from the state of New York with a $400-and-some state loan that's going to facilitate the reconstruction of Belmont. And eventually Aqueduct will close and racing will move to Belmont on a full-time basis. And Maryland, with our redevelopment plan, you can't point to any other state in the country or jurisdiction where anybody's thinking about the future. So we have a unique opportunity, but to think that it's going to be status quo or it should be status quo, I think is a mistake. And I think that the challenge for the authority is to recognize where we are right now in the state of Maryland, where we are as an industry, and how we can best position the racing industry in Maryland to go forward and go forward with a bright future. It's a tremendous challenge. Remember, and I said it earlier, we will not have gaming at our racetracks. We're going to have to figure this out ourselves. We as an industry are going to have to figure this out ourselves, which is the challenge that we had 11 years ago when we had to come up with a solution when Frank Stronach didn't write the check for the slot license. And we were essentially told by the General Assembly, you all need to sit down and you need to come up with a plan that we can stand behind, but you're going to have to figure it out yourselves with the revenues that you have available to you and that we will make available to you through gaming. It's not going to come from anywhere else. So things are going to look different. And that may be a good thing, but we'll have to see. There are going to be changes that are going to have to occur.
Last question, and I'll cut you loose. One of the challenges here, it seems to me, is you have this operating authority. It's going to be trying to envision the future and take over the redevelopment plan. We also have a track operator that still exists in First Racing, the Maryland Jockey Club /Stronach Group. They have made noises about being willing to reduce their footprint in Maryland, or they haven't really made noises that I'm aware of that they would leave Maryland, but they certainly have suggested they might be willing to reduce their footprint. How's that relationship going to work? Are they going to be here? Are they going to leave? How do you see the authority working with the current track operator?
So, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on, Frank, because that's the reason why we have the authority, is that there were suggestions made to the General Assembly last year, which is how we got to where we are now, that the Stronach Group would be willing to reduce its footprint. How do you make that work? And that's when we started looking at this possibility of a public-private partnership, or a partnership with the state and the stakeholders in the industry who are really looking forward-thinking. The rub is that the Astrana Group wants to either keep Pimlico or redevelop Pimlico, but certainly the Preakness. And how do you make that work when you give the industry, you know, the issues and problems of the rest of the year, and they supposedly get, you know, the benefit of the Preakness? That is the challenge. And there are many who believe that it's irreconcilable, and that the only way this works is if the industry gets not only Laurel or Pimlico or whatever this new regime is going to look like, but also get the Preakness, because for decades, the Preakness helped to underwrite racing on a year-round basis. So you've asked the right question. Even if we come up with a concept plan, we're going to have to continue racing at Laurel for the foreseeable future until Pimlico gets done, and if it's a training center or whatever else is going to happen, gets done. So there's going to have to be some kind of a relationship. What that looks like, I don't know. The reason why we're on these six-month extensions, you know, as you know, and I know it became a bit of a controversy last week with the Racing Commission, we've been we'll use the term subsidy, but we've been helping to underwrite racing in Maryland with the 10-year agreement, and that continues. And the question is, to what extent are the stakeholders, the horsemen and breeders who are paying the subsidy, willing to do it, and how much are they willing to commit going forward? Many of us believe that it would be better to take that money and plow it back into the industry, with the industry in perhaps partnership with the state controlling that, rather than paying it to an operator whose commitment to Maryland racing is certainly questionable. And that's a fair question. So those who say, well, why are you doing this extension? Why are you continuing to underwrite them? The alternative is they could shut down. They could have decided on July 1, we're not racing anymore. Is that in everybody's best interest? So, you know, those who are critical of what the MTHA and the horse breeders have done need to think about the fact that people were looking up to us to maintain, and we have to continue racing here until we figure this out. Otherwise, the barn areas are going to close. We're going to close down here, and of course, we're going to have to scatter and go elsewhere, and we may not get that back in the future.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. There are a lot of questions that are going to be facing the Racetrack Operating Authority, and Alan Foreman will be one of the people trying to find the right answer. Thanks so much for joining us here on Off to the Races, Alan.
My pleasure, Frank. Thank you.
Now, all work and no play makes Frank a dull boy, and we don't want that. So let us turn to the actual racing of horses on racetracks and stop talking about all this business stuff. I had an article last week about trainer Carrie Bryan on the racingbiz.com. She's got an interesting story. She was an assistant for Jonathan Shepherd in her very first year as the trainer of record. She won all the grade one jump races at Saratoga. She won the Eclipse Award. Her trainee, the Mean Queen, won the Eclipse Award as champion steeplechaser. I mean, she absolutely hit the ground running. Now she's turning her attention to branching her business out to include more flat racers and not just steeplechasers. She's got a horse named Caroline Christina in the Stormy Blue Stakes Sunday at Laurel Park in search of her first stakes win as trainer of record. Here is Carrie Bryan. Carrie, good morning. Welcome to Off to the Races. Thanks for making a little bit of time for us. Let's start with tomorrow. You're going to have Carol and Christina in the Stormy Blue Stakes going in search of kind of a first stakes win over the flat. How's she doing?
Yeah, she's great. She's training awesome. You know, I couldn't be happier with her going into this, so fingers crossed.
it's always fingers crossed with horses.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's horses. We got to get there. We got to get to Sunday first. Got a day to go.
It's true. You know, when I first sort of got involved with racing, somebody who had been involved in it their whole life said to me, you got to understand, horses spend 24 hours a day trying to kill themselves. So there's
100%. if there's a way, they find it. I'm completely convinced of that.
it is amazing. Now, this filly, let's talk about her for a sec. Chris Durbins is the owner, and she really, really came out running. She broke her maiden on the Preakness undercard and just kind of ran them off their feet going 5/8 on the grass. Were you aware that you were kind of had a stick of dynamite in your hands there?
I was, you know, we were really high on her in the mornings. I mean, she just is one of those horses that does everything right. And she's a little bit unassuming because in the mornings she's actually quite quiet and just goes about her business. But there's always an engine there. And every time she worked, I worked with a good allowance horse of mine, maybe 2 or 3 weeks before she ran. And he was went well, and she probably went even better than him. And that day I was kind of like, all right, we're sitting on something. I think maybe pretty special here. So I was expecting her to come out and run a good race. I mean, quite like that. I mean, I don't think you'd ever really expect him to come and do that first time out. But I'm not super surprised, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, and those races, like on the Preakness Weekend card, can be really tricky because you don't know who's bringing in a pretty nice horse to, you know, to kind of fill the van. And so you see some pretty nice horses there, but nobody was nicer than yours that day.
Yeah. You know, Michael Mass is in that race. I think it just came back and won the other day. So that finished third. So, you know, it ended up looking like a pretty decent race. And yeah, I mean, she broke and Carol didn't have to do too much. I mean, she outran him to the turn and never looked back. So she was definitely, we saw a different side of her on race day. You know, when we took her out of the barn and walked her over, she was on her toes. And Carol said she was like really, really revved in the post parade, but she still was super professional, you know, when she loaded in the gate and did the job. So hopefully now she knows what her job is. Maybe she'll be a little bit better behaved on Sunday.
Make your life a little bit easier.
Yeah,
anyway.
Exactly.
Now let's talk about your background a little bit. You came up serving as Jonathan Shepherd's assistant, and as we're talking about off air, many years ago I had a horse with Jonathan, and I almost feel like I learned more about him as a trainer having the horse we had, who was sort of an inconsequential Swain colt that actually never raced ultimately, but I felt like I learned a lot about him, more about him as a trainer, I think, than if I'd sent him, you know, $1 million yearling, where he would have had to really pay attention to me. But I'm curious, for you, having spent those years with Jonathan, what you took, if you could boil it down to a nugget or two, what'd you take away from that experience that you're using now in developing your own business?
Yeah, I mean, look, I learned so much. I mean, we could talk for hours about everything that I've learned. But obviously from a training standpoint, like, you know, I've tried to adapt my program as well to, like, letting the horses be horses. You know, they get turned out, they get individual attention. Every horse, you know, is treated individually. They have their own training programs to their specific horses, races they're running in, that type of thing. As far as Jonathan as a trainer and maybe, you know, to his owners, I mean, the one thing I actually try to do, I watched towards the end of his career, you know, his communication to all of his owners. You know, he always, as you kind of said, he always made everybody feel important, I feel like. You know, mm-hmm. He took the time with his maiden claimers the same as he would of, you know, his Breeders' Cup horses. And he was the same in the barn with the horses. I mean, he didn't treat Informed Decision really that much different than he, you know, treated your maiden claimer. You know what I mean? Like,
all
right. they all were important to him. And, you know, as I've gotten bigger and I have gotten, you know, I have gotten some nice horses. And obviously Caroline Christina is one of our better horses in the barn. And I obviously have the Eclipse Award winner and the Mean Queen. But, you know, I have a lot of just nice horses and great owners. And that is the one big thing. I never want to be too big that I can't make everybody feel like, you know, they're a part of the stable and know what their horses are doing and feel like their horse is being looked after the same way as, you know, whoever's grade one winner is being looked after, you know, down the stable. So he was great at that. So, you know.
Yeah. And one of the neat things with our little colt, he was starting to get a little coltish, and I think Jonathan called me and said, look, probably going to have to geld him, but we're going to just turn him out in a field with some older geldings, and maybe they could just teach him to settle down a little bit. And that's what they did, and he did. So
I mean, Jonathan had so many methods, and I learned very early. I mean, I used think this will never work. This will never. It always worked. Like the things he would have me do, this will never work. Oh, it worked. You know, you just the things I saw there, and the things we did. I mean, you can't script it, but he just knew, and you know, he was just very in tune with his horses, and you know, as I said, treated them all individually, and I think it showed. And he had so much patience, which is another thing. You know, it's very hard in this day and age. Everybody wants results. Everybody wants them now. You know, it's hard to have patience, but he was so patient and didn't care what his owners said. You know, he would run a horse when they were ready to run and never pushed a horse past what they were ready for. And, you know, I always admired that. Obviously, I came in at the end of his career, so he had had a lot of practice at this, because it's hard early, you know, when you feel the pressure and owners want results and you want results and you want to prove yourself. But, you know, that's a big thing, trying to stay grounded and, you know, do what's best for the horses, not for everybody else involved, because at the end of the day, if you're doing what's best for the horses, the rest follows, you know. So he was so good at that. I mean, he would have 8-year-old maidens winning races because he waited that long. But, you know, he never gave up on his horses, especially his homebreds. I mean, there were 6-, 7-, 8-year-old maidens finally going through their conditions, because it just took them that long to physically and mentally develop into the racehorse that he always believed they would be.
We're talking with trainer Carrie Bryant. She's got Caroline Christine in the Stormy Blue Stakes Sunday at Laurel Park. And that's coming off a first out debut victory. And she's looks to be live. I think it's 4-1 on the morning line. Now, Carrie, you you alluded to, you were working with Jonathan towards the end of his career, and then he left. And I imagine that there was some work for you to do to hang on to the owners and to kind of keep the barn full. Is that accurate? And what do you sort of say to the owners at this point?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today for sure without Mr. and Mrs. Moorhead, Mr. Swire, the Galbraith, and Mr. and Mrs. Naylor. Those four owners, they stuck by me. It was a little messy when Jonathan retired, and things just didn't go the way that Jonathan and I had spoke about at one stage. There were some vultures and other trainers and just some certain things, but at the end of the day, it didn't matter, because the four owners that had the, you know, the best and, you know, the most horses at that stage in his career, they never, ever thought twice. And my assistant at the time moved our horses to Fair Hill Training Center. Niall Seville rented me 20 stalls at that point in time. I only had 8 horses. but I just said, we're going to make this work. So, you know, we quickly started to fill the barn up, and I've since bought the barn with the help of Mr. and Mrs. Moorhead. And we have 60 horses at Fair Hill and 15 at Delaware. And I have a bunch of new amazing owners, and most grateful to those four, obviously, for sticking with me and getting me going, because without them, I wouldn't be here. But then everybody else that has joined, and everyone who hopefully will join, you know, I'm very, very grateful and lucky to have a great group of supportive owners.
Now, one of the things that is interesting, just so, sort of looking at your career, I mean, you you were talking about Caroline Christine and getting out of the gate. Well, man, you got out of the gate well that first year as a trainer, you know, sweeping all the grade one jump races at Saratoga, taking the Jonathan Shepherd Stakes, winning the Eclipse Award with the Mean Queen. But now it seems like you're turning more in the direction of flat racing, and I wonder if you could sort of talk about the thought process that's leading you in that direction.
Yeah, well, I love jump racing, always have, always will be a part of it, you know. Yeah, that first year, you never would script that. I mean, that just doesn't happen. I have to keep reminding the Moorheads that doesn't keep happening.
We don't do this every year.
Four grade ones in 1 year. I was like, I don't think I'll ever top that, guys. But it was magical, and it's great. And the Mean Queen's actually back in training, and it's great to have her back in the barn. And, you know, we hope to – getting ready for Saratoga now, I hope to make a big splash up there in the jump world. But, you know, it was great because it got my name out there. Even though it was jumping, it was still on the biggest stage, and that's so important. You know, that's how you get recognized. And last year I was able to get a couple – decent flat horses that went to New York and could compete and, you know, won some nice races at Colonial and started to get my name out there in the flat world. And basically, you know, that's what Jonathan did. He had jumpers and he had flat horses. And I've always wanted to do that. I mean, my first love in racing was flat racing. I actually worked for Ronnie and Betsy Houghton for 10 years before I worked for Jonathan. So I wasn't even really a part of steeplechase racing for the first part of my career in horse racing. Also, like, to sustain a business, like, I want to do this and make a living and, you know, hopefully train horses for many, many years. And as great as jump racing is, you know, it's seasonal. And, you know, unless you're winning four grade ones a year, it's not financially, it doesn't really sustain itself. You know, you get by and, you know, the owners are obviously paying you to train, but I want to do this where I can, like, sustain a business. And I think having the flat runners is necessary. And this probably will come off wrong, but it's easy to be, you know, a big fish in a little pond in jump racing. I'm not saying that I think I'm great and everything, but it's easy. I've been on top already. You know, I've won an Eclipse Award. I hope I win plenty more. But the flat game is a whole lot harder, and it's a lot harder to get respect. It's a lot harder to get good horses. And I love a challenge. So it's really now, you know, I have the good jumpers. I have a barn full of fabulous jump horses. We're going to go to Saratoga in the grade ones with probably, you know, favorites or close to favorites, and hopefully they all deliver. But the challenge of getting good flat horses and delivering and winning at a higher level in the flat is sort of the thing now that's pushing me, you know, I like a good challenge. Mm-hmm.
It's a good challenge. It can be a challenging game to get into for sure, but you're making a lot of progress. Last question, and I will let you go, but I saw a post you had put on, I think it was Facebook, but on social media, and you talked about the challenge of sort of getting respect in the flat game. I'm curious, you as a younger woman in a pretty male-dominated game still, what did it mean to you to see Jenna Antonucci and Arcangelo win the Belmont Stakes?
Well, first of all, Jenna and I would be friends, you know, before this, and she's a fabulous human being and has been so helpful and supportive of me in general. Seeing that, I mean, I was actually up. I had a runner the week before, and I got to meet Arcangelo in the barn, and I shipped into her barn. And, you know, mm-hmm. It was just surreal to think, you know, we were sitting there a week ago hoping and praying he'd win the race for so many reasons, and he goes and does it. But she is a fabulous spokesperson for this game, especially for us women trying to make a splash. You know, she does things the right way. She's a horsewoman before she's anything else. And I mean, how she's developed that horse, even from just getting him at the sale with, you know, an ankle chip or an OCD or whatever it was, you know, $35,000 yearling, and they took the time and developed him. And, you know, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, the people spending millions of dollars, because you need all kinds in the game. But I think the story of him and what she's done and how she's developed him and the owner and everything, I mean, I think there's nothing better for the sport than that. And as far as, you know, being a woman that's trying to get involved and get horses, I mean, she just, I mean, I idolize her. I just think she's amazing for all that she's done. And, you know, what this has done for the sport is just, you know, incredible.
All right. Good stuff. Carrie Bryan is a name you want to keep your eyes on in the program when her runners come out, including Sunday at Laurel Park with Caroline Christina. Carrie Bryan, thanks so much for joining me here on Off to the Races.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's going to put another episode of Off to the Races Radio in the books. Thanks so much for spending a little bit of your Saturday morning with us here on Off to the Races, powered by The Racing Biz. Thanks to our show supporters, including Richard Hackerman, attorney at law, the Maryland Horse Breeders Association, True Valor, and Wanamakers.com. Thanks to all our guests on this week's show. This week we featured former Maryland Racing Commission Chairman Michael Algio, Alan Foreman, General Counsel of Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association, trainer Carrie Bryan, and Richard Hackerman, attorney at law. Keep up with racing and breeding all week long on The Racing Biz, theracingbiz.com. You can tune in next Saturday at 10 a.m. here on Baltimore Positive to hear the independent voice for Mid-Atlantic racing and breeding. My name is Frank Vespi. Have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you in the Winner's Circle.